Hi, this is Dr. Moshe Pearl, Director of the Neurofeedback International Academy.
Hello, this is Yuri Kropotov, the head of the laboratory of the Institute of the Human Brain in St. Petersburg, the Institute of the Russian Academy of Sciences.
Hi, this is Mirjana Raskovic, Director of the Australian Neurofeedback Institute. You're listening to the NeuroMoodle Network podcast.
Welcome to NeuroNoodle's Neurofeedback and Neuropsychology podcast, featuring neuropsychologists Dr. Laura Jansons, Dr. Skip Brin, Tech Whiz Santiago Braun, and neurofeedback legend Jay Gunkelman. Our goal is to provide information and promote options for better mental health. This is an all-star cast, and I'm more than happy to share their knowledge with you. My name is Pete, and today we have special guest Mirjana Oskovic, Director of the Australian Neurofeedback Institute, Yuri Kropotov from the Human Brain Institute, and Dr. Moshe Pearl, Director of the Neurofeedback International Academy. But before we start, we'd like to thank our Patreon supporters, Outrageous Baking, Tor Talk, Alternative Behavioral Therapy, EG and Me, Sadia M, Jonathan Rowan, January Terrell, and Loretta T. Outrageous Baking is a dedicated gluten-free bakery that has been around for 15 years. Tor Talk wants more people to discover text-to-speech. Joshua M. at Alternative Behavioral Therapy Neurofeedback Service in Vancouver, Washington, says, stop on in if you're in the area and need a 19-channel scan. Please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. It really helps get the word out. If they can't hear us, we can't help them. Okay, welcome to the show, and I apologize in advance with the names, Mirjana, Yuri, and Dr. Moshe. We'll start with Mirjana. Please tell us about yourself and the Australian Neurofeedback Institute.
I'm a senior psychologist, I'm a trauma therapist, and I've been using neurofeedback in my work since 2003. I'm based in Sydney, Australia, and I work for the service that works with torture and trauma survivors. So we are a New South Wales-based service, government-funded, and we work with refugees and asylum seekers. My work for this service started in 2001, when I arrived to Australia as a refugee, and I've been working the service since then. My journey to neurofeedback started with Dr. Moshe Pearl, who is a legend in Australia, who was my first trainer and mentor. Since then, I've introduced to my service also quantitative EEG in 2010. And then Jay Gunkelman was our mentor. And then we started our research with event-related potentials. And then Professor Yuri Kropotov was our mentor and supporter. So as you can see, everyone is connected. World is really small.
Well, you guys are connected. And we had a listener's reach out to us from Australia, and they said they're a big fan of the show, listening in Melbourne, and responding to our call at the end of the podcast for nominations for future podcasts. And they mentioned all three of you guys to come on. So we said, all right, we'll reach out, and here we are. So we want to say, hey, Tyler, great job, great suggestion. Everybody's here. Jay, you bring up Yuri quite a bit. Who did you meet first on the panel?
I believe I actually ran into the Australian group in 1999, perhaps. There was a meeting over there. It was the first one that the International Society had arranged. And I believe I met them at that point. But Yuri and I crossed paths at the International Society meeting at the turn of the century, when it was held in Monterey, when I was the international president. And I invited them, all the international folks at the meeting, to have a free lunch and to consider starting a chapter, which ended up forming the European Group Society for Applied Neuroscience. So I was there at the start of the Australian Society and the start of the international group in Europe. Just pretty much by accident, I bump into these things, you know. So, but it's been a pleasure working with the group in Australia, the Torture and Trauma Survivor Group that I started working with STARTS, S-T-A-R-T-T-S, and the TTS is torture trauma survivors. And it was an interesting, different EEG profile than the simple ADD or depressives that we had been used to working with very commonly. They have some very interesting, unique EEG signatures that end up being associated with them.
Is neurofeedback more common than it is in the States, or which country has picked it up quicker, or is it about the same? Just curious.
My feeling is it's about the same. Population-wise, Australia is about 10 times smaller than the United States. So we have probably 150, 200 active neurofeedback practitioners here. In the States, you probably have a few thousand, maybe a few more, maybe 10,000. I'm not sure exactly.
And it's not quantity, it's quality, though, Moshe.
Of course.
So the EEGs, the QEEGs, the brain scans, it's you have rugby. You have rugby is more popular than American football, right? I would imagine that sport gets a lot of trauma. I was just wondering if you've had a lot of work with athletes in Australia.
I haven't. They don't play much rugby in Melbourne. They play more in Sydney and in Queensland. But, you know, every contact sport, you're going to have brain injuries.
I'm just wondering if they're getting the scan, any athlete are getting the scans, you know, before the season to get a baseline to compare it to. I was wondering if that was catching on yet, especially now with the dry sensor caps that are out there. I was just wondering if that was catching on anywhere. Jay and Yuri, your name has come up a bunch of times, I know, because I've copied and pasted your profile and put it on our YouTube channel so everybody could understand who you are. Could you go over your background, how you started in neurofeedback? Love to hear it in your own words. You're in Russia, right?
Yeah, I'm in Russia. Yeah, that's true. Although I'm professor in several universities in Norway, in Switzerland, in Poland. But yes, I permanently live in Russia. And actually, I have a very long history. I'm quite old person. Yeah, I think that we, Jay, are on the same age, aren't we?
Yeah, I believe so.
You're both very young.
I won't tell you exactly how old you are. You know.
Yeah. And but I think that I quite differ from all of you, because I'm, by the first education, I'm a physicist. Basically, I spent the first 20 years of my career just analyzing the data from the human brain directly from the implanted electrodes. So we recorded different physiological parameters using implanted electrodes like oxygen, slow cortical potentials, like impedance, like impulse activity of neurons, local field potentials, quite many things. And I simply analyzed it. Then I spent probably 10 years of doing different neural networks modeling. But I think that, you know, in 1991, the Soviet Union collapsed, and all my attempts to study the brain, they just stopped because there was no money for research, nothing worked. And that is why I decided that I need to start working with something which is real and which will bring some money to the laboratory. And so that is how I went to the field of neurofeedback. So, you know, in Russia, we definitely have a lot of ADHD, but we don't have access to Ritalin, to any psychostimulants, so that we actually was forced to work with neurofeedback, wrote some letters to different people in the United States, whom I knew by research papers, and they responded to me, and that is how I met Barry Sturman, who was having a kind of workshop in Norway. I met him and I decided to start working with neurofeedback. It was 2000. So I started neurofeedback at 2000. We started doing what we actually knew, learned how to do it. We started doing EEG, EEG spectral analysis, and of course, event-related potentials. And we immediately realized that event-related potentials are quite a good measure of brain functioning, and they're quite flexible on one hand. So if you do some intervention with the brain, so you see the changes in these parameters, in event-related potentials. And we tried to see the same in quantitative EEG, I mean the EEG spectra, and we were not able to find the differences, but we found the difference in ERP. And I think that I came to conclusion that ERP, they have higher potential, higher diagnostic and prognostic power than quantitative EEG. I prepared some slides for today to demonstrate why I'm thinking this. Just as Barry Sturman used to say, show me the data. So I'm going to show some of the data to you and to demonstrate why I think that event-related potentials, that is the parameter that we need to add to our method in clinical practice. So, you know, the psychiatry and neurology are becoming the cognitive neuroscience. So why ERPs are needed in clinical practice? So look, we are looking at the brain through different windows, okay? And one of the window is provided by spontaneous EEG, and the other window is provided by event-related potentials. Okay, and here I show you the grand average spectrogram. So this is a kind of the method that everyone is using. This is EEG spectrum, grand average EEG spectrum. And you can see that there are some, and this EEG recorded in a group of healthy subjects, they are children. And you can see that there are some bumps on the EEG spectrum that corresponds to different frequencies, like there is a frontal midline theta rhythm, there is a parietal alpha theta rhythm, low alpha rhythm, and there are mu rhythms and occipital alpha rhythm. So, there are not many rhythmicities in the brain, and all of them, they have certain functional meaning, and they reflect a certain mechanism of cortical self-regulation. Okay, and here I demonstrate the rhythmicities that can be recorded from scalp electrodes. And we have a family of alpha rhythms, like mu rhythm, parietal alpha rhythm, occipital alpha rhythm. We have frontal midline theta rhythm, and we have a family of beta rhythm, including the frontal beta rhythm, the rhodopsin beta rhythm, the central beta rhythm. And each of these rhythms, they have a specific meaning. And the alpha rhythm, the functional meaning is closing the sensory gate to the cortex. So when alpha rhythm appears, so the gate is closed. The frontal midline theta, the functional meaning is to open the gate to the hippocampus. So when the frontal midline theta appears, so the gate is open. And the beta rhythm, they have quite different mechanisms, and We actually know quite little about the mechanism of beta rhythm generation. Mm-hmm. And here I present these independent components that corresponds to different rhythms. The first is frontal midline theta, and each line is a subject, is a child from our database. So 250 children. And you can see here that not every one of the subject has the frontal midline theta in EEG spectra, only a few of them. And the same goes to mu rhythm. There are about 20% of healthy subject having mu rhythm. Here I present the EEG spectra C3, C4, the area that generate mu rhythm. And this is a superposition of EEG spectra of about 20 children, or I think that of age 15 years old. And you can see that there is quite large variability in EEG spectrum. Okay, and because of this high variability, the comparison with the grand average, actually, you get quite a low confidence level of the deviation from the reference. Now, let us talk about event-related potentials. So you can design many tasks, many psychological tasks in which you can record event-related potentials. So we are using five different tasks, and one of them is keyword go, no go task, in which stimuli are presented in pairs, so like animal, plant. And the subject has to press a button to two animals, animal. And here I show event-related potentials computed grand average event-related potentials. This is FZ, CZ, and PZ. And the green is a go condition, animal go. Red is no go condition, animal plant no go. And black is ignore condition, okay? And you can see the topographies of the different waves that can be selected in this ERP wave, like P3Q, CNV, P3Go, P3NoGo. You see these topographies, and you can measure amplitude. And remember, I told you that there is quite large variability in EEG spectra. And opposite to this, I show you the quite nice variability, and I would say consistently in event-related potential. So this is a PZ electrode, and each line is a subject. So I think altogether it's about 500 subjects. So each line is a subject, and you can see that almost every subject has this component, okay? And you also can see that there is a systematic change of the latency. So this is the age changes from 17 at the bottom to 84 at the top, okay? And the other beauty of event-related potentials, so you can apply different methods of blind source separation. And one of them, the example of application, one of them is shown here. So these are independent components. I mean that latent component, hidden component, you say, and they have quite different functional meaning. I'm not going to tell about the functional meaning, but believe me that we spent 15 years trying to understand the functional meaning of this component. So we know quite a lot about this topic. And just as example, I show you one component, the component that is located at FZ, This is a topography of this component. The functional meaning of this component is that it's actually responsible for quality control. And on the left, you see the grand area shear piece computed for a group of healthy subjects. It's the group was about 200 healthy subjects. And the green line is goa condition. The red line is no goa condition. And on the left, the same, that is computed for a group of patients with schizophrenia. And you see huge difference between ERPs. So in healthy controls, we can see a part, frontal part of contingent negative variation, which is a preparation to receive a stimulus and to press a button. Then in the case of no go stimulus, we have a deflection, negative deflection, which we call N2, which reflected the process of detection conflict. So here is N2 detection conflict, and P3 is monitoring of this conflict. Okay, and these are healthy subjects. And in the case of schizophrenia patients, you don't see it. You don't see the preparation. You don't see detection conflict. You don't see the component of the monitoring of this conflict. Okay. And the effect size of these differences is quite large, is definitely more than one. So that means that it can be used in clinical practice. And the beauty of this, look, the effect size is big. The test reliability we know is quite big. And this means that this component, I mean, this approach can be used in clinical practice. And immediately you can say where to place electrodes of doing any intervention like neurofeedback, it could be TDCS, TMS, whatever. And here I just show you actually the same, quite large variability in the EEG spectrum, in the frontal mean life atherism, and quite consistent earpiece in the case of group of healthy subjects. And here I show you that the earpiece, they are quite independent from EEG spectrum. Here is three subjects. 1, 2, and 3, and this is earpiece in comparison to the group of grand average group. You see quite nice actually correspondence between the grand average and the individual earpiece. And here is EEG spectra computed for this EEG in during the task. And you can see that each of the subject has quite different topography. One subject has a mu rhythm, the other subject has a parietal alpha rhythm, and this alpha rhythm are quite different. I think that it tells you that earpiece and even relate that EEG spectra, they actually reflect quite different parameters of brain functioning. And to summarize our studies, because we did quite a lot of studies in different brain dysfunctions like ADHD, autistic spectrum disorder, OCD, schizophrenia, Parkinsonian disease, and anxiety. And you can see that each of these dysfunction has a quite specific deviation, pattern of deviation from the reference. Deviation from normality, and actually tells you that each of these diseases must have a quite different approach using different methods of neuromodulation, including TMS, TDCS, and neurofeedback. So this briefly what I'm trying to teach people during the last 20 years. Jay knows this, and we with Jay, I remember Jay that we were having a workshop in Lisbon. Remember Cascais in Lisbon?
Cascais, just outside of Lisbon on the coast.
Yeah, yes. And actually, this is actually the first time when I tried to persuade people in the neurofeedback field that to use event-related potential. And you see, some of them actually responded, like Andy Miller, like you also. I think that you also become a kind of person who believe in neurofeedback.
Yes, and it was in Cascais that I asked you if you were using ICA, and you said, "Oh, we tried PCA, principal component analysis, and it just doesn't work." And I handed you the paper from Schwartz Computational from Scott McKeag and his group. 2 weeks after that workshop, I got a disk in the mail with your software with ICA implemented on it. And you received the Russian Prize for Science for using the ICA on the EEG and ERP. Congratulations. I thought of it as a simple tool to take out artifact, and you realized the richness of it seeing meaningful components. So
Well,
you're the real neuroscientist. I'm the tech, you know. So I thought of it as a way to do it.
I'm pretending, Jay. I'm pretending to be a neuroscientist. But in my heart, I'm still a physicist.
I have to suggest that people who are interested in your work should pick up. You have two books. One was a direct result of the Cascais lecture, the first book, and then your second book on neuromarkers in psychiatry, which is a really excellent reference for psychiatrists that want to learn biological psychiatry as opposed to just listening to stories and making wild guesses about medication. So I would urge people to look at your two books as a really quite good reference material.
Thank you. Thank you, Jay.
You know, I have a question, excuse me. Yuri, I'm curious about the international equivalent, but in the States here, we have something called the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, fifth edition. It's the manual that the psychiatrists use to assign diagnosis. Do you have something equivalent there, or how does that work for
yourself? Yeah, of course. We have ICD-10. I mean, you're talking about Russia. Yeah, we definitely have something. And for research, we are using DSM-5.
I see. Okay, good. And so as I'm looking at these graphs, these are amazing that these are, like you say, biological signatures. And so if I'm getting ahead of your talk, let me know. But are you saying that we can use neurofeedback to influence schizophrenia and Parkinson's and these other conditions here?
You know what? I think that in these cases of this severe brain dysfunction, I would recommend using more strong intervention like TDCS, TMS. We are doing this in our country. We are trying to treat patients with using this methodology, TDCS and TMS.
That's great.
Yeah, but you can also try, of course, you can try neurofeedback, like in case of schizophrenia, you can train at FZ, frontal midline theta, to increase frontal midline theta. We know that it can help. At least it can help in enhancing working memory.
And you're saying it helps people test reality. You update working memory, update your mental imagery about what's real versus what you're seeing.
Exactly.
And in Parkinsonism, there's emerging evidence on sensory motor rhythm being useful with Parkinson tremor and the rigidity seen in Parkinsonism as well. Barry Sterman has outed himself as having early stages of Parkinson's disease now. So the founder of SMR is hopefully undergoing a lot of SMR training right now to try to forestall progression for his Parkinson's disease.
Yeah.
Might be a good time now to show our joint research, Yuri, and maybe then you can comment also about our results pre to post neurofeedback.
I think that we met with Jay in Australia once on the conference, and I went to Australia many times, and we worked together. And it was nice memory. I miss those days. You know, I miss traveling.
Yeah, I miss being face to face with you too. I mean, there's only so many people that you can really absorb higher levels of neuroscience from, and Yuri's an excellent source of knowledge in the neuroscience.
So I'll tell you a little bit about what we did together and a little bit about STARTS as well. So our service had a long history of working with survivors of torture and trauma. Initially in the 80s, we started our work with refugees from South America, Argentina, Chile, and since then, we've seen clients from all around the world. So wherever the war is, after that, we'll have an influx of refugees. So we've seen clients from Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran. And what I could see in my work as a clinician is that post-traumatic stress is more brain disorder than mental disorder. And early on, I was employed in 2001, and by 2003, it was quite clear that all techniques and therapies that I've learned to use didn't really make a big difference for quite chronic and complex cases that I've seen at that time. And I was searching for a new way of addressing problem that I could see, that is physiological problem. And I came across, there was an interview with Moshe. It was for Current Affair, if I remember well. It was about one of your clients. It was a child with quite severe ADHD and behavioral problems who didn't respond to medication and all other interventions, and neurofeedback really made a big difference. And immediately I could see some parallel between this was, if we could see physiological problem addressed through neurofeedback, and I've seen a lot of children in a school setting who were traumatized, who had very similar presentation. And I got in touch with Moshe, got trained by Moshe, and bought the equipment and introduced to my service. And over the years, I could see that neurofeedback is really useful and it's helping with many presentations with symptoms related to post-traumatic stress disorder. It helps with insomnia, with symptoms of depression. And then I got really curious because I couldn't see what is happening in the brain. I could see just throw traces while we are training, but I really was curious about how, what is there any brain signature of trauma? And we bought the equipment in 2010 and started to collect our data. And then what I could see is that we see different profiles. And just by trying to compare a group of clients pre to post neurofeedback, we couldn't find really one difference in quantitative EEG that we can say, this is what is shifting and changing due to neurofeedback, because profiles are different. And changes pre to post neurofeedback are different. And protocols that we were using were different. And then I came across Professor Kropotov's work, and it really made sense that if you look at the task, if you give brain a task and look at changes, there will probably is more likely that we can see the similar signature pre-neurofeedback changes related to trauma that ERPs can capture. And I expected also that if you're doing a good job, then we should see some consistent differences post-neurofeedback. This was our study that was done in 2015-16. And we were measuring event-related potentials pre to post-neurofeedback. And because we are a clinical service, we are not a research service. We are just curious clinicians. What we did was we had two group of clients. At that time, we had a lot of clients that we referred for neurofeedback, and we had a huge waiting list. So what I decided to use as a research protocol is to, first of all, measure at the baseline when we admit clients to our clinic using clinical and also brain measures. And then one group of clients, as they are coming to the service, they're receiving neurofeedback, and those that are coming later are waiting for service. And I've just taken clients first, 13 clients that receive neurofeedback, and first 13 clients that are waiting for neurofeedback on waiting list, and then assess them at the end of neurofeedback treatment and for waiting list group at the end of waiting time. Group that was waiting for neurofeedback was still receiving our usual therapies, and we are using a range of therapeutic interventions to help clients deal with the consequences of trauma. So we were using a range of protocols, and even this can tell us that clients are having different, we can see different brain signatures. Some of them are having more frontal lobe problems, hypercoherent alpha frontally. There is a lot of problems such as fast beta frontocentrally, and a lot of changes that I believe that you Jay will talk later about temporal lobe changes. So therefore, there is no one protocol, neurofeedback protocol, that will really fit everyone. And you can see this is just from those 13 clients who received neurofeedback. You can already see that they were trained with different frequency range that were either rewarding or inhibiting, and the range of protocols that we use to address symptoms that they had. And most of them have symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, depression, chronic pain. And that's why we, over time, use more than one protocol with each client. So I'll just looking at this page. How can you expect to see the same difference pre to post for each client, but we were using different protocols for each of them? And you're using a range of protocols for each client. Most of the time, we were working somewhere in the range of SMR, working with sensory motor cortex, and also a lot of protocols, temporal parietal cortex, and then more towards the end of the treatment, more just trying to engage frontal lobe, some protocols we used as well, and also to address depression. So these are results for a group of clients that these 13 clients who received neurofeedback and 13 on waiting list. We could see big difference in symptoms of trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, and depression. Both groups improved, but neurofeedback, those who received neurofeedback improved much more significantly more than waiting list group on all symptoms that we were measuring. And just looking at neurofeedback group, what we could see is that all symptoms related to post-traumatic stress disorder, intrusions, numbing, anxious arousal, dysphoric arousal, avoidance, all symptoms, they're decreasing as a result of neurofeedback treatment, anxiety, depression as well. And also we were measuring attention and working memory. We were using digit scans from WISE, and we saw improvement in cognitive functioning as well. Then the question was, are we going to see also differences in event-related potentials? And this led us to talk to Professor Yuri Kropotov. I asked him to analyze our data pre to post neurofeedback. We met at one of the conferences, and after the conference, we stayed together. We brought our data to Yuri, and he was with us in the room while he was doing the analysis. And I remember really well that Yuri wasn't happy with our data. It was messy, it wasn't well processed, and he was complaining while he was doing this. And both me and my research assistant, we really felt so bad. And I felt like sinking in the chair and I want to disappear because there is Yuri Kropotov and he is criticizing our work. He was like, this was terrible. I never saw such a messy data. And at the end, he cleaned everything, prepared our data for processing, processed our data. And then what we could see just change in his facial expression. And he said, bingo, we need to go and celebrate. And what was good is, okay, we did something good. Maybe we are not good researchers, but at the end we are good clinicians and actually change in event-related potentials in NOGO P300 changed significantly. And then we wrote and published paper together. But Yuri, I would like you, if you can comment on this data and also why did we, what can you tell us why P300 is the one deviation from the norm that we've seen? And why is this one the change after neurofeedback? Can you just help us understand a little bit better what we see?
Well, it's actually quite similar to what we found in case of neurofeedback that was applied to ADHD. Remember that we have a paper in 2005 in which we showed that ERPK can be quite sensitive to session of neurofeedback. And we compared a group of good responders and bad responders. And we compared these two groups and we found similar things, the changes in this ERP. And actually ERP that we were showing here, they reflect the cognitive control. You know that when animal is presenting, so the subject is prepared to receive animal and he prepared to make a response. So it's a prepotent response, but when instead of the animal, the plant is presenting, the subject has to withhold. First of all, the brain has to detect the conflict and then he has to withhold from pressing a button. And there are two operations. One is conflict monitoring, the other is inhibition, and both of them, they are operation of the cognitive control. And this picture simply tells us that the cognitive control in this group of subject is enhanced. And we know that there is a kind of negative, a kind of inhibition between the affective system and the cognitive control system, and look like the cognitive control system has been improved, and which would inhibit the enhanced overactive the affective system of the brain. So basically, that is consistent with what we see: improvement in attention, improvement in cognitive control, and improvement in affective domain. And the next step would be probably to decompose this ERP into independent component and to show what kind of independent components is actually improved. That would be the next step.
And Yuri, we saw not just changes in cognitive functioning, but actually decrease in symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder.
That's what I'm saying. That the improvement in the cognitive control inhibits the overactive affective system.
And maybe lack of cognitive control actually limits ability of traumatized clients to disengage from traumatic memories and to modulate their emotions.
Yeah. Well, we know from your sign that there is inhibitory interaction between these two systems. Although they work independently, but they have quite clear inhibitory control. So the high active affective system inhibits the cognitive control system, and vice versa. Large overactive cognitive control system inhibits the affective system of the brain.
So can we say then that improvement in cognitive control underlies recovery from trauma. It's a top-down process.
I think it would be probably too straightforward. We don't know actually what is happening in the brain when we're doing neurofeedback. It could be both. Changes could be both. But remember that still you are using neurofeedback EEG, spontaneous EEG for doing neurofeedback. You are not using anything which would be associated with event-related potentials. So it's not easy to say what is exactly happening. Mm-hmm. And we are using different protocols. So, but in